Now, the world was in mourning after the Islamist terrorist attack on Manchester. But in our grief, we perhaps overlooked two other attacks. Suicide bombers killed three police officers in Jakarta. And about the same time, militants besieged a southern Philippine city called Marawi. The conflict goes on and parts of that city are still under siege. Martial law has been declared there. Both incidents are linked to Islamic State terrorism. And late yesterday, IS claimed responsibility for an attack on a Manila casino, even though the Philippines police still insist that it has nothing to do with terrorism. Still, should we be worried? Well, yes, says Zach Abuser, who's a Southeast Asian terrorism expert. He says the security situation in Southeast Asia is very poor. Zach Abuser is professor at the National War College in Washington, the author of several books on terrorism and security in Asia. He joins us via Skype from his home in Washington. Zach, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what evidence is there linking these two events to IS?
Well, we should start with the fact that they might be both linked to IS, but they are independent of each other. The evidence right now from Indonesia, the two bombing attacks, has come from the fact that the two suicide bombers were tied to a group known as JAD. Mm. And that group has pledged allegiance to the Islamic State, and the Islamic State, a central media organ, has taken credit for those attacks. But it's important to know one thing, and if Australians have a long memory of this, of Jemaah Islamiyah and their attack on the Bali nightclub in 2002 and subsequent attacks, including the bombing of the Australian embassy, JI tended to micromanage attacks. They did everything themselves. Mm. And what makes IS different is that they are very willing to allow groups that are simply inspired by the Islamic State or lone wolf actors perpetrate attacks, and then they take credit for it. In the case of Indonesia and Malaysia, every attack that has been executed or at least planned has more or less fallen into those categories. The members were recruited by Southeast Asian members of the Islamic State in Syria, in Iraq, and they've been, you know, given incredible free range to execute the attack. There is very little evidence of command and control,
yeah,
other than Zach, this simple recruitment.
Yes, Zach, one of the things that has really spooked security experts in the Philippines are the reports that there are foreign fighters, you know, Malaysians, Indonesians, okay, they're local, Saudis again, an Indian, I think there were some others, among the dead militants. Do you know anything about that?
So there have long been foreign fighters in the southern Philippines when JI was getting started in the mid to late 1990s. They were bringing in Al-Qaeda trainers simply because it was too expensive, too complicated to get Southeast Asians all the way to Pakistan and Afghanistan. That really dried up as the security situation in the southern Philippines improved in the late 2000s. But once again, we're seeing this pipeline emerge. In the fighting this past week in Marawi, Philippine Army claims that 8 foreign fighters have been killed. Mm-hmm. And that includes 2 Indonesians, 2 Malaysians, 2 Saudis, a Yemeni, and a Chechen. And they believe that there are many more there. Yes,
yes, go ahead. Zach, can we follow the money trail also to the Gulf as well? I know you say that these groups are very organic, they pop up, they're not sort of centrally organized, but do we know if there's any money coming from the Gulf?
There is money coming in by very small amounts. I don't think that there is a large flow of funds into the region. This has always been a secondary area for the Islamic State. This is not their primary area of operation. And certainly now, as they're fighting to maintain what they have in Iraq and Syria. So I just do not see evidence of funds coming in. There were more in 2015 and 2016.
So money isn't a motivator then for the Southeast Asian terrorists?
Oh, no, they're doing this purely for ideological reasons.
But is it the Saudi sort of influence to Wahhabi ideology?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The spread of Wahhabism has fundamentally changed the nature of Islam in Southeast Asia. And you just cannot help but notice that what was once so tolerant and pluralistic and willing to embrace ethnic and religious minorities, how intolerant it's become. And we saw it last month in the election in Jakarta.
Yeah. And we should mention, of course, the Wahhabi ideology is the extremely austere ideology that, as you say, was once pretty foreign to Southeast Asia. This all feeds in, Zach, to the broader concerns about IS fighters returning to Southeast Asia. One of our very fine local reporters, Lindsay Murdoch, has reported in the Fairfax Press that, quote, Australia and other nations in the region are so worried about the threat of homegrown Islamic State militants returning from battlefields in Iraq and Syria, they've convened a summit in August to coordinate the threat. Do you think the return of homegrown militants poses a really significant threat to this region?
Yes. Now, I want to put this into context. There are not that many Southeast Asians who travel to Iraq and Syria. Numbers thrown around are of around 1,000 to 1,200 people, but that includes wives and children. The actual number of militants was several hundred. We know there was a large enough contingent based in Raqqa, Syria, that they formed their own Bahasa language company, known as Katiba Nusantara. Some of those have been killed. Some were suicide bombers, but some have started to trickle back. Now, the Malaysian government has a lot of tools at their disposal in terms of being able to detain these people without any evidence. They can detain them indefinitely. Indonesia, however, does not. There's nothing against the law for these people to go and fight overseas and return home. The Indonesian security forces are trying to keep tabs on them, but they are simply spread too thin. And let me give you a different reason why this is important. Back in January 2016, when you had the attack in Jakarta on the Starbucks, you know, overall, not many people were killed in that. You know, half of the casualties were the attackers themselves. Only two of those four individuals had had any sort of military training. And that was back in 2010 in a JI training camp. They had both served prison terms. So you could imagine that if you get people with battlefield experience returning back home, just how much more lethal those even low-level attacks could be.
Yeah. We're speaking here on Saturday Extra with Zach Abuser. He's a professor at the National War College in Washington, an expert on Southeast Asian security and terrorism. I want to ask you specifically now about the Philippines. I thought that for all of his manifest faults and perversities almost, that Duterte had actually been a man who thought he could negotiate with the Islamist rebels in Mindanao and the parts of the Philippines. That's all exploding, isn't it? What's happening there?
Yes, it's gone to pieces. On the one hand, I believe that Duterte has empathy for the Moro people. He's from Mindanao. He understands that they have very legitimate grievances and that the governments in Manila have long treated Mindanao as an internal colony. But that said, he really has not been focused on moving the peace process with the Moro Islamic Liberation Front forward. The government was very close to a landmark peace agreement with this movement, which has around 11,000 fighters back in 2014. Legislation was moving through the Philippine Congress to implement this peace agreement when in January 2015, a botched police raid led to the death of 44 special action forces on the government side. And that just collapsed the peace process. It was an election year to boot, so it was really a political minefield.
Yeah.
And since Duterte came to power, you have had this steady proliferation of what I would call black flag groups. Though the Moro Islamic Liberation Front remains committed to the peace process, you have groups like the Maute group that took over Marawi City. You have other groups, the AKP, the Abu Sayyaf has declared allegiance to the Islamic State. So you have all these different little groups and cells that are starting to appeal to disaffected members of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front and gain support.
Yeah, Zach, we've only got a couple of minutes, but you made a very important reference there to the besieged city of Marawi. Look, just very quickly, take us through what happened there. Paint us a picture of what's going on there.
So last week, the Philippine military was trying to capture in a member of the Abu Sayyaf, and they walked into an ambush. And members of the Maute group, which had pledged allegiance to the Islamic State, took over the city. They had several hundred fighters, and they held the city, held people hostage in the city, in hospitals and schools. This is not a large city by Philippine standards, around 200,000 people, but it caused a flood of refugees. Maybe 80% of the city had to flee. And 10 days later, the Maute group is still holding parts of the city.
Yeah, I can tell you what this sounds like when you talk about internal refugees. It sounds like Syria, doesn't it? I mean, is this Syria on Australia's doorstep?
Well, on a very small scale, it is something certainly to be concerned about. And as long as the Moro Islamic Liberation Front don't have a peace process that they can look forward to, they have no incentive to be a responsible stakeholder and help the government root out groups like the Maute group.
Well, look, very instructive to speak with you. Professor Zach Abuser is a Southeast Asian security expert. He's the author of many books. He's also professor at the National War College in Washington. Zach, thanks for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.